is, if you don't understand anything, raise your hand during lecture and I will explain. We don't have to be so formal. So please don't hesitate to interrupt me. The other thing is, I will retrace myself. Now, to answer one question first, yes, Jerusalem exists in print. Schocken Publisher, unfortunately not a paperback. It's a very small book. Here's the original edition. A very small book. And if you want to read it, it won't take you long. It exists. But at the moment, I see you've taken the English out of the library and I've taken the German out. So, it exists. It's a very small book. Now, I would today like to come back to Moses Mendelssohn, therefore. Because I think, go much too rapidly for what follows and not deeply enough. And therefore, before I come to the Gentile view of emancipation, I want to come back to Jerusalem of 1783. I want to come back, in other words, to that balance I talked to you about, the balance of Enlightenment and Jew. Now Mendelssohn, as a true son of the Enlightenment, believed that religion should persuade and teach, but should never be enforced. This, of course, went for all religions, Christian and Jewish and everything. For as he put it, man's principles and his conviction cannot be put under restraint. They can't be put under restraint because they belong to man's cognition, to the realm of man's cognition, and cannot be restrained, his principles and his conviction. For in the end, the only valid thing are the rational judgments of the mind. And as Mendelssohn and the whole 18th century believed very deeply, that principles and convictions meant, in fact, the rational judgment of the mind. Therefore, religion could not constrain it. Judaism knows no forcing, no command. And then he deals with Moses on Sinai. You remember, in case you've forgotten probably, that on Sinai, Moses, on the command of God, gave the tablets of the law. Mendelssohn's plot on this important event is as follows. Even Moses at Sinai never commanded. He only appealed. He only appealed to the human will. He only appealed to action. Remember how important action was of the Enlightenment. You can put it this way, that what Moses did in Sinai was to activate the categorical imperative among the children of Israel. He did not force, he did not command. He activated the categorical imperative. His message was clear, that man is never the means, only the end. That man is a creature of rational self-determination. That was Moses' message, and it activated the categorical imperative. Again, Mendelssohn reduces Jewish law to rational truth, to fundamental. In the end, he says, what is the fundamental? And he comes back to a very famous story from the rabbinical literature. It's the only time he mentions it. This is the story. A pagan asked Rabbi Hillel, teach me the whole of the law while I stand on one foot. And Rabbi Hillel said, that is easy. Love your neighbor as yourself. Moses Mendelssohn took that story and said, that is it. That is Judaism. That is, in fact, its essence. Love your neighbor as yourself. Now, this is one side. But what I must point out to you straight away, that the speaker, Rabbi Hillel, is a Jew. The sentiments are sentiments of the Enlightenment. That is what must concern us and what is important. But there is, as I said last time, the ceremonial law. God gave it to the Jews in Leviticus. God gave it to the Jews. Why? In order to preserve the purity of the doctrine, the purity of the minimum doctrine, the doctrine that Rabbi Hillel taught while you stood on one foot. Why then is law necessary? Why are these 316 commandments, I got it wrong again, are commandments necessary? Why are they necessary? Well, they are necessary for this reason, he tells us. For amidst heathen and fools, God has to keep his message pure. And as the world is full of heathen and fools, including the people of Israel, Moses, after all, didn't really activate their categorical imperative. You may remember that he immediately made a golden calf and danced. So as the world is full of heathen and fools and weak people, it is necessary to keep the message pure. And to keep the message pure is the matter of the ceremonial law. The ceremonial law forces men to penetrate into the essence of the religious message. Why? Law itself does not force men to thought. The Jewish ceremonial law merely prescribes deeds and acts. He says the Jewish ceremonial law, right about this, just tells people what should be done and what shouldn't be done. But by telling people what should be done, by prescribing deeds and acts, it leads men to thought. As he put it, and I quote, "Man must be driven to act, and then they will be driven to thought." That is the essence of the ceremonial law. To put it slightly differently with him, the ceremonial law, all these commandments, link action and thought with Jewish, within Jewish spirituality. A spirituality always defined in rationalistic terms. By doing all these ceremonies, you are linking deed and thought. You are becoming, in a way, for Moses Mendelssohn, a whole person. The ceremonies are to keep the thought pure, to keep you from building a golden calf, to keep pure the rational message, if you like. It would not be unfair to say that through the ceremonial law, the Jew becomes a unity, body and soul, through action, through deed. What is the end result? The end result is that the Jew is the custodian of the Enlightenment, that the Jew is the custodian of rationalism. He is the custodian of the Enlightenment. Through his ceremonial law, through the message he keeps pure, through his separateness, he is the custodian of the Enlightenment. The Christians can never be that, because they have to believe in supernatural revelation. So that it is Judaism which is really the custodian of the Enlightenment, and not Christianity, which can never be it by revelation. God and Moses proclaim the universal rational law. Clearly, in this, deism is integrated. The Enlightenment is integrated into Jewish separateness. Jewish separateness gets a message. We shall come to that. The mission of Judaism. The mission of Judaism is to proclaim the Enlightenment. It gets a message. What then is Judaism? Let us sum it up with Moses Mendelssohn in Jerusalem. He sums it up concretely. First, it is the eternal wisdom of God, not forced on anybody, but merely recommended. It is the recommended eternal wisdom of God, recommended to your rational self, to your categorical imperative. That's one. Secondly, it is the historical tradition. It has to be, because you have to take account of the ceremonial law's existence. The reason for the existence of the Jewish nation covenant with God. All right. Commonplace. But what does this covenant with God say? God has given to Jews a special rationale because it's given to Jews this kind of religion and the ceremonial law to keep them separate and to keep it pure among a world of fools and weakness. Here he says there is authority, the authority of God, not the authority of man. Here for once he allows authority. Thirdly, these laws and commandments lead to happiness. They are partly written in the Bible and partly tradition. And I come now to tradition and a question you asked me, does Moses Mendelssohn refer himself to the later Jewish literature? The answer is no. And the reason it is no, I will come back to. This is a Jewish apologia. So he was writing after all not only for Jews, but mainly also for Christians. And so he does not refer himself at all to the Talmud or to the later Jewish teaching, except for this Rabbi Hillel story that I gave. Laws and commandments lead to happiness. Why? They connect thought and life. And so he sums it up finally. I do not see how those who are born into the house of Jacob can discard the ceremonial law. We can think about it, but that is all. The only thing that can change the ceremonial law is a new revelation of God. That is a repetition of the event in Sinai. Nothing else can change. But the ceremonial law, to make it quite clear, the ceremonial law is merely an outward form. It leads you to think. It leads you, in fact, to a general rational attitude towards life. That is really its purpose. Now, this is a Jewish apologia. It is written in German, not in Hebrew. Back to that in a minute. For an audience of the philosophers. But the book became a charter of freedom rather than one along the long lines of Jewish apologia. The law, then, was a vital part in keeping Jews separated, but separated them as carriers of an eternal rationality. Moses Mendelssohn believed that the children of Israel were chosen, but they were chosen because they were the special children of a rational and universal God. The covenant was symptomatic of this, and so was the ceremonial law. Now, this, I think, will deepen for you the balance which I talked about last time. But to this I must add something else. For eventually, of course, in this kind of ideal, religion did become a separate sphere from human activity. Why? This is very important. Why? The Jew was a Jew only in his observance of the ceremonial law. In everything else, he was a child of the Enlightenment. The Jew was a Jew only when he ate, when he married, when he kept himself separate. And to Moses Mendelssohn, the essence of separation is, as he put it, that Jews cannot eat with Christians and that they cannot marry Christians. This he stresses again and again. But only in these acts is a Jew a Jew. Otherwise, he is a part of the Enlightenment, indeed, a leading one, just as our other autonomous human beings. Here it is very important that Moses Mendelssohn wrote German, and that when he wrote Hebrew, the Hebrew among his circle was artificial and stilted. That Moses Mendelssohn and his whole circle rejected the language of the ghetto. They rejected the ghetto generally. This means a more colloquial Hebrew, but above all did it. Moses Mendelssohn stopped in a way. The utter contempt for Yiddish, which will be endemic in all of Western Jewry. Why? therefore it is not to be used. This is again an idea of the classicism of the Enlightenment, which is behind it, which I told you about. And this idea of impurity, as over against classical simplicity and order, works against Yiddish, for Hebrew, but above all for German. Moses Mendelssohn founded in Berlin a Jewish free school. The first school for Jews, or attended by Jews, in which, besides Jewish subjects, German was taught, and philosophy. Now here you can see what inevitably happened. While the ghetto civilization was saturated to every act of life with, if you like, Jewish theological concern, here Judaism became indeed a religion. And to separate itself from the ghetto, it even got a new name, which were love. You were not a Jew. You were, in fact, of the Mosaic religion. That were love. To come back to it. And I remember my own shock, which wasn't until I came fairly old to America, that somebody actually called himself a Jew rather than of the Mosaic religion. I thought that was deeply shocking and vulgar. So that it was a matter of the Mosaic religion, because Judaism now was in fact separated out. You were a person of general humanity. Judaism tended to become a religion, like the kind of hour in school you had on that subject. So in spite of his ideal of thought and action, he did separate Judaism into a Jewish religion, or better, we must call it Mosaic religion, to shed all ghetto connections, and the world in general. This is also part of the balance of being a Jew and an enlightened European. To summarize, Judaism then not only does not teach anything in conflict with the Enlightenment, as Christianity did, but it also makes possible an equality, a common ground, and yet a separateness, and yet a separate. These ideas became formalized in what has been called, or what was called, the mission of Judaism. The mission of Judaism was what? The mission of Judaism was to spread rationality and the Enlightenment. That was not. Even an early socialist, like Moses Hess, for example, a Marxist great friend, will believe, for example, that it is the mission of the Jew to spread reason throughout the world. The trouble with this mission is clear. The ceremonial law, what about it? That which was for Mendelssohn an integral part, but it soon, of course, became less and less so. There is no doubt that Mendelssohn, the little hunchback, was a thoroughly harmonious personality. Thoroughly harmonious. That for him the balance indeed worked between separateness and enlightenment. Harmonious. Whether it worked for his descendants, we shall have to see. But as you have asked me questions about the Enlightenment, I want now to read a letter which his youngest son, Abraham, wrote to his daughter, the favorite sister of the composer, Felix Mendelssohn. And that letter, I think, will again repeat, but you notice what has happened. You notice that the ceremonial law drops away. The daughter, and of course, as you will see, converted to Christianity. All of Moses Mendelssohn's grandchildren converted to Christianity. All of his sixteen, and don't laugh, because they were serious, and if you like, in many ways, valid reasons under this had to do so. Quite valid, quite clear. Now, this was the letter he wrote to his daughter on the occasion of her Christian confirmation. That is to say, the sister of Felix Mendelssohn in 1820. Abraham, his son, the son of Moses. Does God exist? What is God? He is a part of ourselves. And does he continue to live after the other part has ceased to be and where and how? All this I do not know, and therefore I have never taught you anything about it. But I know that they exist in me and in you and in all human beings, an everlasting inclination from all that is good, true, and right, and a conscience which warns and guides us when we go astray. I know it, I believe it, I live in this faith, and this is my religion. This I could not teach you, and nobody could learn it. But everybody has it who does not intentionally and knowingly cast it aside. Then he gives us an example as a girl's mother who says, come back in. The outward form of religion your teacher has given you is historical and changeable, like all human ordinance. You see what becomes of the ceremonial law. If the ceremonial law, like all human origins, is changeable and no longer actually given by God, as his father thought, then the balance falls. Then Jewish separateness has indeed no sense at all. Some thousands of years ago, the Jewish form was the reigning one, then the heathen form, and now it is the Christian. We, your mother and I, were born and brought up by our parents, that's Moses Mendelssohn and his wife, by our parents as Jews, and without being obliged to change the form of our religion, have been able to follow the divine instinct in us, in our conscience. We have educated you and your brothers and sisters in the Christian faith, because it is the creed of most civilized people, and contains nothing that can lead you away from what is good, and must that guide you to love, obedience, tolerance, and resignation, even if it offers nothing but the example of its founder, understood by so few and followed by so few. We shall come back to the phenomena of conversion. But I am reading this now to show you how in a way difficult the balance was. That once you believe that the ceremonial law was no longer given by God, then indeed it became changeable. Then indeed Christianity became the form of religion of indeed most civilized people. Then indeed you slid into this conversion, which after all in 1820 affected the chief and perhaps the greatest intellect among Jews. So that what you have therefore here is a balance, but perhaps a precarious one. I must also say that you are amused by the balance. But remember that the balance of Moses Mendelssohn, of Jew and enlightenment, of enlightenment as the special custodian of Jews, and special hand of the Jews, has two effects which will last. First of all, it will be the essence of Jewish reform. It is the essence of the tenuous links which before Zionism bound most of your parents to Judaism. Secondly, it will mean eventually, indeed, a persistence of enlightenment ideas among Jews when the outside world had long, long abundance. It will make, as the Zionist once said, the Jews 50 years behind their time in thought. Without any judgment, this is true. This is because these enlightenment ideas will reject, of course, Zionism, will reject nationalism. Nationalism is evil in the enlightenment. Man is universal. There's no room here for Zionism. Will reject Zionism, will reject all irrationality. This will be a Jewish tradition for which will last and will find its final flowering together with a goodly dose of moral indignation in the radical Jewish intellectuals of our time. Recognize yourself, so you shouldn't laugh when I talk about Moses Mendelssohn. He is, in a sense, very much a part of you. Now then, I think I have said a little more to make the balance a little clearer about which we are going to talk. And now that we've seen a little more of how a Jew faced the possibility of assimilation, we must now go to the Gentile who championed it. For the two things interplay. As I told you at the beginning, Jewish history is part of European history in general. What did it mean for the Gentiles? A more complex question. And I want to start it by going back to 1711, the beginning of the Enlightenment, and to look for a minute by the crisis produced by the burning of the Frankfurt ghetto, which happened in 1711. The ghetto in Frankfurt, one of the largest and most famous, associated in your minds with the Rothschilds. We have that in common, I'm sure, or other less desirable people. The Frankfurt ghetto in 1711, the Rothschilds had no great difficulty. The historian, the Christian historian of this awful fire, approved of the Frankfurt City Council, which gave shelter and food to the Jews, and indeed condemned now in 1711 the insults and hard treatment of the Jews by the mob. The mob, of course, took the opportunity of the burning of the ghetto for insults and hard treatment and for an anti-Jewish riot. That's not what is interesting. What is interesting when this Christian historian at the beginning of the Enlightenment faces a knotty question. Should Christians shelter Jews? And still more knotty, if you shelter a Jew, should he be allowed to pray in your house? These questions go, after all, to the essence. Not only should Christians shelter Jews, but should they be allowed to pray in your house? That really gets to the essence. What is the answer in 1711? What is the answer? It is as yet an ambivalent answer. You are as yet at the beginning of the Enlightenment. Christians should shelter Jews, but keep apart. In no case should they take Jewish money for rent. He hopes that the Jews will not rebuild their synagogue, for the fire is a judgment passed upon them for doing the work of the devil. So you still have here the traditional idea of Jews as the burden of humanity's sin, together with witches, the unreformed church, which I've told you about, the synagogue, the Jewish religion is condemned, a condemnation which will remain, as you will see throughout the Enlightenment. Nevertheless, it is recognized too, and this is new, that Jews are human beings, and therefore you should shelter them. You shouldn't accept their tainted money. You shouldn't allow them to pray in your house. But you should give them shelter. And the social measures, the first of their kind in Europe, with the Frankfurt City Council took, largely for economic reasons, to be sure, which the City Council of Frankfurt took, were approved. Here, then, century-old patterns of thought are clear once more, but also an emerging idea. What should I call it? An emerging idea of charity. That charity must be extended to Jews as well as Christians. This makes this account by Jakob Schutt, whose name you don't have to remember, of the burning of the Frankfurt ghetto rather important, even in the history of the Enlightenment. Makes it important in the history of the Enlightenment for an extension of the idea of charity. And the extension of the idea of charity is, in a way, the beginning of ideas of human universalism, which I have told you before. Now let us skip the century. Let us go to 1781. For in 1781, things were different. The Enlightenment had worked, and now appeared one of the other most famous books in the history of modern Jewry, a book written by a Christian, Christian Wilhelm Dohm. Book
with the title,
of About the Improvement of Jewish Citizenship. 1781, Jerusalem 1783, Doom 1781, About the Improvement of Jewish Citizenship. A century had passed since the burning of the ghetto. If Jerusalem was to be important as a Jewish reaction to emancipation, a charter for Jews who wanted to be Jews and enlightened, Dome was to be the charter for the Gentile reaction, the favorable Gentile reaction to assimilation, which also will set the tone for much of the next century. Christian Wilhelm Dome was a man of the Enlightenment, a close friend of Moses Mendelssohn. Indeed, he was in what we might call the Mendelssohn circle. What has happened here in the similarities and the contrast to the attitude of 1711 is indeed illuminating. I think I must stop here for a minute to ask you, as you seem to be very shy, what questions you have. Friday will be from now on question time, dialogue time, will not be lecture time. It's just this time because you haven't gotten into the material very deeply yet, so I thought I'd advance it a little. Some questions may have arisen, and I don't want to do it yet.
You seem to be implying an absence of theology.
You mean in Mendelssohn? The theology is there in the ceremonial law. It is absent in the traditional way in the Judaism as the rational religion. Yes, it isn't theology, it is the universal rationalism of the Enlightenment. Yes, yes. There is nothing in Mendelssohn anymore about what he called the hair splitting of the rabbis. You see, that's what he rejected. God is irrational God. Let me put it this way. Mendelssohn's God is the same as Voltaire's God, or Diderot's God. The same, except that the Jews are his chosen people. And Voltaire thought the intellectuals were his chosen people. Yes? In Berlin. This all happens in Berlin. His circle of friends, I should come back to it. Rich Jews, bankers, of course, because remember, the people who lived longest among the Gentiles were the bankers, the court Jews. Bankers, by and large, a wealthy Jewish aristocracy, if you want to use that term, we'll have to use it later anyway. A wealthy Jewish aristocracy mixed in on equal terms for the first time with the Berlin intellectual aristocracy as well, with the philosophers. And among them even clerics. Dohm was a cleric. Dohm was a Protestant minister. Mixed in with clerics, but it didn't matter. He didn't live to see it. They as good children are. But first of all, no, it's not quite true. I'm going to come back to that. The girls, of course, made famous marriages. He no longer had to see. You see, Dorothea Mendelssohn, his daughter, eventually becomes Dorothea Schlegel, and then is married to Schleiermacher, the great theologian. His girls, this is very important, we shall see. His sons never converted, nominally, in order not to hurt their mother and father while they lived, but they educated their children as Christians. Moses Mendelssohn died fairly early and fairly young, so he never witnessed this. His wife did, and I can't tell you offhand what her reaction was, but the sons and the children, of course, converted completely. And they also, the girls, made very important intellectual marriages into the center of German intellectual life. As well, Felix Mendelssohn, the composer, is a concept to you, I'm sure. All these were converted, and I'm going to deal with this, Corey, in some length, because it is a case study of this kind of conversion, which became very important. They took another name, too, you know. They become the Mendelssohn Bartholdy family. Yes, I'll read you another letter why this was done a little later. And as Mendelssohn Bartholdy, they become a very famous banking family right up to 1933. Well, he did, because that wasn't really a problem. That wasn't really a problem. We are really before the time when in these circles the doubts about the existence of God become very important. No, that was not yet an issue. I mean, it's clear. This was not yet an issue. None of his children doubted the existence of God. Certainly not the composer Felix Mendelssohn and his grandchildren. No, no, that was not an issue. Yeah.
You say there was a divine foundation for the service
yes.
of the law, it's not just a question.
Yeah.
It's cleared away from conversion.
Yes.
It seems like the ontological difference of Christianity.
Ah, that's a very good question, and it's my fault because I went ahead too far. Of course, you see, the Christianity to which they converted was a romantic, untheological Christianity. Yes. Their commitment was really to a kind of romanticism. This is why I should have left it. To a kind of romanticism which was almost inseparable from a kind of romantic Christianity. That commitment they did make. But what fell away is that there was no reason for them to have a Jewish commitment if they rejected the ceremonial law, if they rejected the literal importance of the Bible, which the Romantics rejected, don't forget that, the literal importance of the Bible, there was no reason. And once there was no reason for the ceremonial law, then what is going to keep the Jews as a special custodians of rationalism? I mean, within the universe I am discussing, you know, what is going to keep it? And the answer is nothing, and as Abraham Mendelssohn said, you might as well join the ranks of most civilized people. And most civilized people are Christian, by which he meant again intellectuals, by the way. Most civilized people, that is, most intellectuals, important ones, were romantic Christians. Yes? Like Schlegel and Tieck and Herder and Hegel and Schleiermacher. You see? All of them. And to this, of course, we shall come. But you are coming in first to the great, to a period of a very important conversion. Yes. It's a very important conversion. Yes. No, I don't think there's much to it.
There's
God praise
that
you praise
a place above you.
I don't want to get off what is today. That comes later. But the thing is, whatever is today, things have changed somewhat. Not as much as you think. Things have changed somewhat. Mendelssohn spends in Jerusalem page after page disproving the idea of the so-called stern Jewish God. God is not stern. He never commands. He only appeals. He never forces. So it isn't the Jewish God of the Christian's imagination. Calvin's imagination, actually, where it comes from. It is not the Jewish God of Calvin's imagination, the stern lawgiver. He is the gentle persuader. Mendelssohn's God in this balance is the gentle persuader. The rationalist philosopher, the gentle persuader. That's the point. Yes. Yes.
None.
Again, I must say what we usually say, but I suppose which has to be articulated. Emancipation and the ideas of emancipation were going to affect every Jew in the end, obviously. But at the beginning, this was a matter of an elite. The masses of Jews still lived in ghettos in Eastern Europe and will continue to do so. Not affected. Effective only slowly. We shall talk about that. effected slowly and stunned to revolt, but slowly. At the moment, it is an elite, of course, what will affect everybody. This is an elite intellectual circle. The whole Enlightenment was an elitist affair. The ordinary people went to Mass, joined the evangelical movement, emoted with John Wesley, and so on, rather than read Voltaire. That is clear. But that is done because you start with an elite, and you end up, after all, with everybody. Yeah.
No.
He never lived in a ghetto. No. There was, in fact, no ghetto in Berlin. No ghetto in Prussia at all. That's due to previous historical development. The only Jews admitted to Prussia were court Jews. And the only part of Prussia where there was a large Jewish population, which is where most German Jews come from, as you know, is Posen. An English word for Posen, well, the Polish is Poznan, is Posen in that district. And the Mendelssohn family, like all our families, came originally from Posen. But there was never a ghetto, and that never applied to Prussia. There's never a ghetto in Prussia, you see? Because the admittance of Jews was really on the basis of wealth. You know, it's historically different. Yes. Because you wanted to be part of humanity, part of the intellectual scene. You didn't want to stand apart. You see, Moses Mendelssohn solved the problem for you. Let me put it this way very quickly. Moses Mendelssohn solved the problem. You wanted to be a true and enlightened, and in fact, Moses Mendelssohn said, be a practicing Orthodox Jew, and the Enlightenment is in your custody. You are, in fact, the pure enlightened. Therefore, you have joined civilization. You have joined up with the Lewis thought, the best. Well, similarly, the conversions come this way. Because when the Enlightenment gives place to Romanticism and a new Christianity, the problem becomes very difficult. How are you going to join with Schlegel and with Tieck and Schleiermacher, with all the great romantics, or Hegel? We shall have to talk about Hegel at some length again. It's going to be very important for the young Hegelian Jews like Marx. The question is, how are you going to join this? That's the problem. If the Enlightenment had lasted in Europe, there might not have been a problem, but after all, it didn't last. So how are you going to join Romanticism and Christianity, which from 1800 on was certainly the dominant intellectual mode of thought? That you must look at it in this one. Yes, in the back.
How do you say that an antichrist is necessary to make Christ effective?
Yes, yes.
How does that tie in with the Christian desire to assimilate the Jews?
Because they give it up. They gave up theology. Christianity was evil. Christianity was a superstition. And all that they left of Christianity was the categorical imperative. And perhaps Christ is example. Christ is a kind of example of a good man of the Enlightenment. No. Remember, as I said last time, for Dome and all of these, Christianity was a deep superstition. And so was Judaism, as you will see in a minute when I talk about it. Was given up. Yes.
Going to the 11th turning event a little bit deeper, it seems to be a turning event that I don't understand.
The turning event only because of the attitude. I mean, Gettos burned quite a few places. But here you have in 1711 a historian who is writing about it, and for the first time a change of attitude, which you will see culminated in Rome, which again connects with the Enlightenment. The change of attitude that I have said. Not only can you shelter Christians, Jews, I'm sorry, but to extend to Jews the idea of charity. This may seem to you no big bit, but it was at the time a very big bit indeed. And indeed goes into the universalism of the Enlightenment. But I said it also to make clear to you that some of the old still remain. He hoped the synagogues wouldn't be rebuilt. Judaism is a superstition. You mustn't take the Jews' money under any circumstances another oath as superstitious, usurious, or usurious. So you mustn't fall into the clutches of usurers, and you mustn't take their money. So you have here a mixture. That is the important thing about the burning of the ghetto. Well, I think we're through. If you have any questions, do interrupt me during lectures. We go on.